Okay, we are delighted this morning to have J.P. Moreland with us, distinguished professor of philosophy at Talbot Seminary, a man with many degrees, has written many books, a graduate of Dallas Seminary. I've got to at least mention that one. He was on staff with Campus Crusade, started a couple of churches. He understands the ministry of pastoring. And the book Kingdom Triangle just received a significant award from Christianity Today just last month. So God has blessed us in this area and blessed his kingdom with Dr. J.P. Moreland and the gifts that he has given him. He has come to share with us. And our purpose in having these forums is so that you can finish well. This isn't about techniques of ministry. This is about your heart and your mind being devoted to the Lord and serving him in the thick and thin of ministry. So we are here to encourage you and help you to finish well. JP, thank you for coming and sharing with us this morning.
Well, thank you, dear brothers and sisters. It's really great to be here. I've looked forward to this, I think, primarily because I feel a kinship with you. We're fellow soldiers. We've both been in the ministry. We know what that's like. Can you hear me okay? Average? Okay, great. And so I know where you're at. I've planted a couple of churches, and my wife and I are very heavily involved in our local church, along with the pastoral staff. We love ministering in the church. You might as well consider us an additional staff couple, that we're not getting paid for it, but we love ministering and receiving ministry in our church. And so I've looked forward to this chance just to share with you and to talk about some issues that are very important to me. This May I finish 38 years of ministry, vocational Christian ministry, and I, like you, want to finish well. I want to be a man of integrity. I want to fall more in love with Jesus each year that I serve him. And I certainly don't want to be disqualified. I want to finish as strong as I can. And in the 38 years I've ministered, I've done an awful lot of reflecting on how to grow as a Christian, how to make a deeper, more penetrating impact into the culture, and to do it in a way that flows more naturally from just who I am and who we are. And it was because of these reflections and a crisis in my life that hit me about 5 years ago, which I'll share with you a little bit later, that I felt very strongly led to write the book Kingdom Triangle. And the book really is an expression of who I am. It's not something I had to write because I was concerned about something. I did write it for that reason. But what I tried to do was to express how I see and feel about the world and about the Christian life in there. And my hope is that there will be something that I'll share here this morning and in there that will be deeply touching to you. That's my basic hope. And what I've been asked to do is to talk a little bit about the book by way of overview and some of the key themes in there that I pull out that might be useful to you. I'm going to make sure that we have plenty of time to interact, so feel free to be formulating questions or comments, expressing disagreements if you'd like to. That'd be great. What I try to do in the book is, the first half of the book, I try to analyze the culture and give as penetrating a Christian critique of culture as I possibly can. And then I try to chart a way out of the situation in the second half of the book. Let me just express a little bit about the first half. In terms of analyzing culture, I have long been convinced that it's very, very important for us to understand at a very deep level the culture in which we live, largely, not primarily so we can reach people, but primarily so we don't get sucked into it in an inappropriate way. And it's so very easy to internalize ways of seeing the culture and ways of seeing life and ways of seeing reality that we simply absorb from all of us from the culture without knowing we've done so. Let me give you a simple example. I would be willing to bet that most of you think that DNA contains your genetic information. I am profoundly convinced that that's false. I actually think it is the soul that contains genetic information, not DNA. And if I'm right about that, that's a big deal. Because what that means is you will never be able to explain the development of the human body without believing a soul exists. And if that's the case, then what that does is that puts soul talk back into the public discourse. And then the next step is that raises again, afresh, questions about life after death. Now, I don't particularly care to talk about DNA this morning. But what I'm suggesting to you is that we have so absorbed a scientistic way of seeing reality that if we have a group of scientists who make a claim about something, we will often belly up and give up huge real estate territory over to science without knowing we've done so. And we thereby tend to very easily get socialized into a scientific way of seeing the world that is contrary to a biblical way of seeing the world, perhaps. And so what I do in the first half of the book is I talk about worldview struggle. And I do it at a level that I believe is very, very deeply personal and absolutely critical. And there are three worldviews today that are fighting for the allegiance of the American people. One of them is Christianity. The other two are naturalism and postmodernism. And in the book, I try to analyze these with some degree of rigor. The single most important worldview in American culture is scientific naturalism. It wears the trousers. It dictates to people what they really believe about reality. It is scientists who carry authority to speak in culture. It is the scientist who has the right to define reality. It is not the theologian or the pastor or the philosopher or the ethicist. It's the scientist. I'll illustrate that in just a minute. What is naturalism? Well, basically, naturalism is the view that the hard sciences are the only source of knowledge that we have about reality. So that it is chemistry and physics and neuroscience and biology and that provide us with hard, cold, solid, reliable knowledge of reality. And everything else that's outside the hard sciences cannot provide such knowledge of reality. And the naturalist, based upon this understanding of knowledge, that it's really the scientist who carries cognitive authority in culture, then we absorb a worldview that basically says that the physical world is all there is. We are inclined then, just as a practical application, to see a lack of health is due to sickness is due overwhelmingly to disease and germs and not demons. If you go to the rest of the world, 80 to 90% of the Christian church, when someone's sick, automatically explores the demonic component of that and makes sure to deal with demonic attachment in addition to their cultural forms of medicine. And yet, we tend not to have demons on our radar screen in this culture. And if someone's got cancer or some kind of a sickness, we tend to think that what they need is medical treatment, and we take them to a doctor, and we don't consider that there might be a demonic cause for the disease. And that is a way that we have absorbed a scientistic view of the world. And this is a serious problem. At Biola 3 years ago, we had a young lady that kept passing out in class and literally falling out of her chair. She'd be sitting at a desk and she'd pass out and clump into the floor. And she went to a couple of specialists because her heart would start racing and she would pass out. And they thought that she had some kind of damage in her nervous system or heart. So they did tests on her, couldn't find out what was wrong. They put a monitor on her chest to try to get a readout when this would happen. She went to see Dr. Clint Arnold, who's a New Testament professor at Talbot, who's pretty well versed in demons. Clint told me when she, but this was in the Bile, the newspaper, but said when she came in the room, his office, he sensed a demon in her. He could feel it. And he cast it out of her, and she was completely and totally healed as a result of that. Her medical condition was due to a demonic attachment. It had nothing to do with medicine. Now, all I am saying is that scientific naturalism tells us what's real. And we in the church then try to adjust biblical teaching so that we don't come into conflict with a naturalist view of the world. The only place that we're willing to raise our heads might be with the evolution issue, but that's about it. And so what we have are parishioners who come to our congregations who don't believe a whole lot. They are trying to believe, but deep in their hearts they're afraid that naturalists have discovered something that makes belief in a supernatural Christian religion something that's a little bit superstitious. Now, the second worldview is the third one is postmodernism. And basically, postmodernism, as I'm going to define it for our purposes, is a form of community relativism. It's not individual relativism. It's relativism relative to your group. And it's the idea that all truth and reality is completely relative to your community. And what is real to one community is literally not real to another community. Does God exist? Yes and no. Both. He exists to Christians, and he doesn't exist to Buddhists. So there's no right answer to the question, does God exist? There are as many answers to that question as there are communities. And as you know, it's bigoted and intolerant to assert that there's an answer that is a meta-narrative that's true for everybody, because precisely if you're a postmodernist, you believe that these sorts of things are relative to your community. Now, what these two worldviews have done is a couple of things, and I analyze this in the book, and I'll just put this on the table. One of the things the hegemony of these worldviews is, by the way, naturalism now is the dominant view in the university and in the media. If you just look at Dateline NBC or 2020 or read Time or Newsweek, just sometimes listen to these shows with an eye toward looking at the authority structure that's conveyed. And you will find that it is scientists that carry authority. Quick illustration of this that still stands out in my mind. In the Columbine tragedy, after that event, I will never forget, for about a week and a half, our entire nation was searching for knowledge in answer to our questions about what was happening among young people. And Brokaw and Jennings and Rather and CNN paraded neuroscientists, psychiatrists, psychologists, sociologists, regularly across the screen to try to provide answers as to what was happening. Now, pastors were involved, but their involvement was to comfort the families, which basically means that they were allowed to sing the national anthem. But when the real game got going, you don't want to ask a pastor what's going on, because pastors don't know anything. Christian thinkers don't know anything. In fact, the idea that there could be a Christian thinker is like, you know, an oxymoron. because Christians accept a relativistic kind of paradigm that helps a certain group of people who need faith and so on. But you wouldn't want to ask a youth worker what's going on in youth culture. You'd instead ask a therapist. And so what happened is that conveys an attitude of authority subconsciously to the American people. It undermines the authority of the pastor in his own church, believe it or not. Because very often authority is based on what one knows, and rightly so. We give dentists authority to do certain things and lawyers authority to do other things precisely because we assume they know, they have a body of knowledge. If that makes sense to you. So what we have here then is that both naturalism and postmodernism have created a cultural context where basically two things have followed from it. Number one, we now have what I call cultural anxiety. Anxiety is now a cultural phenomenon. Now, I'm not talking about anxiety that results from losing your job or anxiety that results from some specific incident. What we have is a culture where increasingly the default position is anxiousness. And this is due to a couple of three things. Number one, the pace of our lives and stress. That's certainly the case. I think the second cause, and this is in the literature, and I'm not just making this up. The second cause that many people will report is the loss of community. So there's an isolation. So the pace of our lives, which creates stress, the loss of community. But the third, interestingly enough, is moral relativism. Moral relativism creates a culture of anxiety. Why? Because the idea is there's no real meaning to life any longer. There is no objective truth about why we're here. There's no reason for any of this. You can make up any truth you want. And see, people realize intuitively that a made-up truth is not sufficient to give your life to. Why would you devote 10 years of your life striving for a made-up truth when after the end of 10 years you could just unmake it and make up another one? That would be a 10 years poured down a rat hole. So do you see that people are wanting to know if there really is a reason for any of this? They're looking for people who are confident that there's a purpose to life and there's a reason why you and I are here. And the first impact of the naturalist postmodern view, where I just pointed out that the naturalist is basically in charge of the university and the media, the postmodern worldview is overwhelmingly communicated through the arts and through the entertainment industry, as you know. But we are barraged with these on a daily basis. So the bottom line here then is that we have a culture of people who no longer believe that you can know there's a real purpose to any of this. The second implication of these two worldviews, and I mentioned these in the book, is that there is no longer a belief in knowledge outside the hard sciences. People no longer believe you can actually know answers to questions outside chemistry and physics. Now, I'm going to come in just a minute to what knowledge is, but for right now, let's just say it again. The idea is that if you are trying to solve a problem in chemistry, you could reach the point where we could all know what the right answer is. We could know what it is. But religion or the abortion debate or a political issue or an issue in art, that's a beautiful or ugly painting, the idea is that no one could ever know whether an answer to that question is right or wrong. And so as a result of that, in the secular culture, knowledge of truth has been replaced with satisfaction of sensual desire. If it is not possible to gain a knowledge of truth, then the pursuit of truth is no longer a viable option. So people will no longer organize their lives around the pursuit of truth, because at the end of the day, no one can know when you found it. So instead, people organize their lives around the satisfaction of desire. And the greatest evil that you can do today is thwart the satisfaction of desire. This is why the abortion controversy is going to be hard to win, because abortion is tied to sexual promiscuity and guarding no-fault sex without feelings of guilt or suffering repercussions. Abortion is not about women's rights on the other side. It is about free sex. That's what it's about. And that's because sex and other forms of sensual desire satisfaction is the point of all this. Anybody who stands in the way of someone satisfying their desires any way they want will immediately be ostracized socially. So we got an interesting job here. And so this is essentially what we've got. Now, in Kingdom Triangle, I go into much more detail about this sort of thing, and I give you some insights and some quotes I think you could use in your teaching that would be very useful. But I don't want to spend the whole time on analyzing the problem here. What I'd like to do is to ask the question, what can I do to make sure that I am growing as an authentic lover of Jesus and I'm different? How can I, is there an approach to this thing that is helpful to the individual and the corporate local body that puts us in the best position possible to over time legitimately be different and provide a radical solution to a culture that is increasingly putrefied and creating people who need Turkish delight? Because in a culture where postmodernism and naturalism reign, and knowledge of truth is replaced with satisfaction of desire, you will have a culture that is addicted. And that's primarily because we were not created to pursue desire satisfaction as our ultimate telos, though it's appropriate within the proper limits, of course. But as an unbridled fundamental raison d'etre, as a fundamental reason for being, it is not an adequate justification for one's 4 score and 10 on this earth. And it is contrary to the way we were made. I put it like this. I mean, I was on a talk show a while back. Why are you against homosexuality? And I said, well, I wouldn't want to put it that way. I would want to state it differently. And he said, well, what's your view? And I said, I do not want people that I care about driving their cars on the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. Say what? The people I care about have paid a lot of money for their automobiles. Too much, in fact. And those cars were made to function and flourish as cars and last longer when you drive them on pavement. You drive one of those guys down on the bottom of the ocean, you maybe get 20 or 30 yards if you're lucky, and that's it. You're going to rust the thing out. And how could I... So I'm not against driving cars in the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, as though I've got this kind of deal where I've got this moral law and I am for people having flourishing automobiles. Now, just we were made to flourish best in a heterosexual marital relationship, and I care enough about people to where I want them to flourish most in this area of their life. And if you practice sexual relations outside that context, including homosexuality, you're not going to flourish as a person over the long haul, because that's like driving the car in the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. That ain't the way you were made to function. And so what we have now is a situation where the people are addicted to Turkish delight, and they desperately, desperately need us to hold out calmly and non-angrily and with a great sense of personal confidence with an alternative. Now, what I did several years ago was I decided to do a detailed study of both the book of Acts and the early church up until the 400s. And so I actually flew to Chicago so that I could interview an expert in the early church fathers, and I barraged this guy with questions, did some reading myself, but I asked him a ton of things about the fathers of the church, because, I mean, he knows these folks like you can't believe. And as a result of a good bit of time thinking about the church in the first 4 years, when it literally outlived and outthought and overpowered a pretty powerful culture that was aligned against it. My question was, how? What did they do? What were the things that were uppermost in their minds that they felt like whatever else we do, this constitutes who we are. This constitutes who we are in the broader context, so that I could make sure that in my own family, in my own life, and then those I love and care about, would at least under my influence be concerned to maintain these things. And I discovered that there were three things that were central. They're central in the book of Acts, but they continued to be central among the fathers and of the church and the church itself for 3 to 4 centuries after the death of the Lord Jesus. And I call these the three legs of the kingdom triangle. I'll mention them briefly. The first one was that they took Christian teaching as a source of knowledge of reality and not just true belief. They took the Bible and Christian theology to be a source of knowledge of reality and not simply a source of truth that had to be accepted by an act of faith. This is lurking in the neighborhood here, is that they cared to foster a life of the mind in their congregations. And this is not just an old codgety ivory tower professor trying to justify his job, though I do have to do that on occasion. This was part of the culture of the local church. It was a part of the culture of the Christian community that the Christian church emphasized learning to think Christianly and to distance from other ways of thinking that were contrary to a Christian way of thinking. And undergirding this was a view of the Bible not simply as a source of truth, but as a source of knowledge of reality. Now, what this approach, I believe, requires is for you and me to come to a deeper understanding of what it means to say something is a source of knowledge. And this raises the question, what exactly is knowledge anyway? And how does knowledge differ from truth? Now, I clarify that in great detail. There's a very clear difference between knowledge and truth. I'm not going to spend time on that this morning. But what I'm suggesting is that our people need to have a simple definition of knowledge, and they need to be told that the Word and serious Christian reflection provides knowledge of reality just as chemistry and physics and mathematics and the best treatments in American history and the best treatments of literature provide knowledge of their subject matter. It is absolutely critical that we don't want to stop using the truth word. We do want to use the truth word, but we want to always use it in the context of the knowledge word. We want to treat our scripture as a source of knowledge, genuine knowledge of reality, not simply a source of true belief. And again, to do that, I think, requires some investigation about the nature of knowledge in order to clear up misconceptions. Let me give you two misconceptions about the nature of knowledge, even though I admit I've not defined it for you this morning. But it's easy to get that in the book. I'm just kind of telling you why that's there. The first misconception of knowledge is that if you know something, you've got to be certain you're right about it. Now, that is a standard of knowledge that's way too high. You can know something, but not be sure you're right. You can actually have knowledge of something. You can say, you know what, I actually know that this financial decision was the right one. but I'll admit I might be mistaken about it. But I do, in fact, know it's the right decision. So knowledge is consistent with doubt and with a lack of certainty. This is a big deal. And in fact, in the book, I list 5 full pages of verses that use knowledge and not faith. And you will, if you do a study of knowledge, you will find it's used more than the word faith. We are a religion, not of faith, but we're a religion of knowledge. As a matter of fact, in my own view, we are never called to exercise faith in something that we don't have some knowledge about. So that we are a knowledge people. We're like scientists. We provide knowledge of our subject matter. And Paul says on one occasion, this I want you to know with certainty. Now, if I were to say to you, I would like a hamburger with pickles, that presupposes that it's possible to have a hamburger without pickles. And so for Paul to say, this I want you to know with certainty, he implies that you could know something without being certain. And so we just want to keep in mind for people that you can actually know that God is real or know what a text says, even though it's in the same breath you can say, but I've got questions and some doubts, and I admit I might be wrong, but I do in fact take myself to have knowledge of this particular thing in question. Knowing something doesn't shut down further investigation, but it does provide confidence. It does provide confidence. The second thing about knowledge that I'll mention very briefly, and this is, I think, absolutely critical, is that you can know something without knowing how you know it. A lot of common sense people know a number of things, but they don't know how they know it. You know, my mom and dad were blue-collar workers, and they knew certain things were right and other things were wrong. They knew those things were right and wrong. They knew there was a God. But if I sat down and said, okay, I want you to give me arguments to support this claim. Now, that's my job. They couldn't have done that if their life had depended on it. So you don't have to know how you know something before you can know it. If you did, you could never know anything. Because if you had to know how you knew something to know it, then you'd have to know how you knew in order to know it. And this gets long pretty quickly, believe me. You have to be able to know some things just plain and simply without knowing how you know them. Now that's a big deal because a lot of people will say, well, I don't know that I can defend my view on this. So how can I know it if I can't defend my view? And the answer is you don't have to be able to defend your view to know something. You just don't know how to defend it to someone else. Well, so that'd be a nice thing to learn, but it's not essential. That's all I'm trying to say. Now, do you see how helpful those two clarifications might be? Because what it will do is it will assure people that knowledge isn't this thing for experts only, and I can't have it unless I can take on all comers. That's just nonsense. Common sense people know a ton of things. The Bible's been tested by people and proven true for at least 2,000 years and longer, and pilgrims have put it to the test, and it can be relied on as a genuine source of knowledge of reality. So the first leg of the triangle that I'm trying to emphasize is the importance of fostering a Christian ways of thinking, but at the center of that is the recovery of the Bible as a source of knowledge of reality and not merely a source of truth that must be accepted because we have certain presuppositions or something of that sort. The second area that was emphasized was the formation of a tender inner life through spiritual formation. It was the use of certain spiritual formative practices to develop tender inner lives. And this was absolutely critical in the early church. This is why we have the Desert Fathers, and we have a whole host of people that begin practicing a wide range of spiritual practices in order to develop an inner life of tenderness and gentleness and peace and a texture of joy. And I try to go into why these practices are powerful and why they do what they do. And that's the second leg of the triangle that needs to be in place, I think, in addition to a life of the mind. I think it's important for us in our churches to continue to work hard at fostering these practices among our people in our own lives and experimenting with them together. Experimenting with them together. These are experiments and learning, which ones do I need now? How do I learn to do this given my life? How do I engage in solitude? There are ways of actually engaging in solitude in your car when you're driving. One of the techniques is to drive in the slow lane. It really is. And there are ways of doing this, and there are very practical ways of suggesting this to people. Now, I want to warn you about something in this section of the book. I recommend a practical application for getting rid of anxiety that I've had a small percentage of people, less than 5%, claim is New Age. And bless their hearts. what I have done is I have taken a medical practice from medicine, not from New Age people, and I have woven it into the book as a way of meditating. Now, I'm going to share this with you very quickly, but I'm alerting you to this heads on. Basically, what scientists have discovered is that there are as many neurons in your heart muscle as there are in any subregion of your brain. And I actually think that we think not only by using our brains, but we also think by using the heart muscle, where the heart area is a form of intuitive knowledge rather than of discursive knowledge. And so this region of the body is actually what the soul uses to intuit the world. The soul is different from the body, but it uses body parts. My soul uses my eyes to see. My mind is not my brain, but my mind uses the brain to think discursively. And my mind uses the heart area. C.S. Lewis called it the chest area from the medieval thinkers, but men without chests were people who had discursive thought and visceral feelings, but they had no sense of good or evil, no character. Remember that? So the heart medicine is coming along in line with what the great medieval thinkers that knew all along, and that is this area of the body is used to be intuitively aware of reality. Now, grant that for the sake of argument. What happens is that if you're anxious about something, if you're like I am, you tend to obsess on the thought and try to protect yourself by going over it all the time. I return to it. You know, I win all the arguments with people that are threatening me. And they get free rent in my head because they're there with me and I'm having to try to defeat them and to protect myself from them. And or some issue in my life, I'm trying to show, am I going to be okay? Is it going to hurt me? Well, you get the point. Now, my problem is that it's when I do that, I start getting in a rut and it's hard for me to get out of that. Now, there's a technique that you can use to learn to have joy and peace in your life. And basically, here's what it is. It's in the book. I'm just giving you this quickly. You got an obsessive thought. You freeze it. You say, just hold that thought for a minute. You go to the heart area. And you basically try to feel what you're feeling in the heart area. There are three ways of doing that. I list them all in the book, just I'm telling you this again. One way to do it is to try to breathe in and out of your heart area. Act like you're breathing in this area. Another way is to try to feel the left part of your heart, the right part of your heart, the front part of your heart, the back part of your heart. A third way is to just touch this area very gently. And what you want to do is to feel whatever is going on here, even if there's no feeling there. Once you become aware of this area of your body, you do what's called CFAN. Compassion, forgiveness, appreciation, and non-judgmentalism. And you go to a memory where you have either given compassion, forgiveness, appreciation, or a non-judgmental spirit, or where you have received compassion, forgiveness, and you hold that memory until the feeling that you experienced when that happened gets set up right here. For me, and I go to different ones, but one time I walked out of a class, and a colleague of mine, Gary DeWeese, grabbed me in the hallway. He's a big old teddy bear kind of a guy, a Santa Claus-looking guy, and he grabs me by the shoulders, puts his face right here, and he says to me, "Man, have I told you recently how stinking much I love you?" He said, "I can't tell you how much you mean to me, and I just love you to death, Jay." Well, when I go to that memory, my heart is flooded with appreciation and affection. Once that emotion is established, you go back to that thought and you drag it into the heart area and you take the emotional power out of it. Now, this is a way of meditating in the heart without meditating in the head all the time and running yourself ragged. That is an example of a spiritual discipline that I now practice 3-4 times a day. When I was first learning to do this, I did it probably 40 times a day. But what this does is it allows you to carry with you joy and peace and affection throughout your day. It's an incredibly powerful tool. It's like journaling. Journaling isn't in the Bible, but it's a spiritual discipline that can be added to this sort of thing. Now, the third leg of the kingdom triangle has been my own journey into signs and wonders. And I believe that the early church practiced healing the sick, dealing with the demonic, and receiving prophetic revelation and words of knowledge and words of wisdom through dreams and other forms outside the New Testament. Now, this is where it gets a little controversial for people, but it shouldn't, and I'll tell you why. Are you aware of what's happening in the church around the world, that the church is literally exploding beyond belief around the world, and 80% of it, according to missionaries, is due to an outbreak of Book of Acts kinds of miracles that are happening around the world? And I believe we ought to be seeing this kind of thing more in our own churches, because this is not an evangelistic phenomenon. It's a God loves people phenomenon. It has little to do with evangelism, and it just has to do with the sort of God that we have. Now, the bottom line is that when you begin to try to recover in the evangelical church the importance of learning to pray effectively for the sick to see your prayers answered, learning to actually discern the presence of a demon and dealing with it appropriately so it doesn't look like the movie The Exorcist, learning to receive prophetic words and words of knowledge that can be given to people by way, as we're told in 1 Corinthians, of edification. What I want to insist on, without alienating any of you, is this is not a charismatic, non-charismatic issue. As a matter of fact, it's not even a spiritual gifts issue. This kind of ministry is rooted in two things theologically. First, the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is here now, and it is meant to be manifested with these forms of power. That's just all there is to it. I mean, you cannot read the Gospels and the Book of Acts in the first 4 centuries of the church where they continued to heal the sick and continued to liberate people from the demonic. Did you never heard of John Knox, theologian? Did you know that he was more known in his day for prophetic revelation than he was as a theologian? He received prophetic dreams from God, and he was able to predict some things that happened to the local cardinal before it ever took place. He walked in the power of the Spirit in the area of the prophetic, but he wasn't charismatic. Now, if you are, that's fine. I don't have an axe to grind. What I'm suggesting is that this is fundamentally an issue of the kingdom, that it's a supernatural kingdom, and we need to learn to live in and employ that power. The second thing, it's a ministry of Jesus issue. Jesus' ministry was done out of his human nature. Let me say real quickly that when I was saved in the 60s, I was taught that what Jesus did proved he was God. No one believes that any longer in the New Testament world. You will not find a New Testament professor at Talbot that believes that. It is now widely acknowledged that what Jesus did in his ministry, he did solely as a human being, filled with the Spirit, in observance of where God was leading him. What that means is we can do what he did. And when he said, "Greater things will you do," he meant that. And today there are more people being raised from the dead. We had a man whose eye was blinded by a grenade in Vietnam for 20-some years, who was instantly healed in our prayer room after 20 minutes of prayer. We had a Jewish woman who had 51 points of cancer who was dying. The doctor said, "It's all throughout your body, you won't live." Didn't believe in Jesus. Came to the prayer room 4 Monday nights. Nothing happened the first 3. The 4th Monday night, She felt heat pour over her body, went to the doctor 2 days later, and the doctor said, I don't know how to tell you this, but you have no cancer anywhere in your body. Totally healed. She's a believer now. Converted to Christian. Yeah, I know. But does God heal all the time? No, of course not. But you can learn how to pray for the sick. You can learn to get better at this. There are ways of doing this that are more effective. It's not a technique. It's a way of working with the nature of prayer itself. And so, that's the point. What I'm suggesting is that this really has got nothing to do with your view of spiritual gifts. Wherever you come down on that question, this kind of ministry is fundamentally a ministry of the kingdom of God and of continuing to carry out the ministry of Jesus, which, among other things, ought to manifest power. Now, are there abuses in this area? Hello? But there are also deadnesses. I mean, I've experienced that in my own life. And if the kingdom triangle is in place, where I'm valuing theological and biblical reflection, I'm valuing being thoughtful and learned in this area and regarding this as knowledge, I'm not using healing as a way of avoiding my own need for day-to-day faithfulness and spiritual disciplines, I am committed to the daily process of spiritual formation, then healing, you see, becomes another part of this picture that is protected through the valuing of theological reflection and knowledge and the valuing of daily process. This keeps it in balance. So for me, these are the three legs of the triangle. I'm out of time. So I hope that you found this stimulating. I have very practical suggestions in the book about how to take one of these legs further if you're interested. And I've got the best books that I found to read if you wanted to follow up on one of these. Like, what's the best book on healing? I've got a recommendation of that. Might be wrong about that, of course. Those are my opinions. But they're there to help. So we have about 5, 10, or 15 minutes left. Yes, my brother.
Maybe it's implied in what you're saying. Is there a natural extension to this triangle in our community life together?
Absolutely.
Is one of God's signs and wonders Acts 4 that we live together, not capitalism, not communism, not militarism, not materialism, but Holy Spirit-driven life? What does that look like to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And what I think this sort of thing will do is it will produce a form of flourishing community where people are growing in their God confidence and their power that they possess to love and care for one another, where they're not trying to gut it out on their own. So there are all kinds of that, and that's one of them. You bet. Yes, sir.
How about the ticklish thing, Dr. Mullen, of a person like yourself who's a high profile Christian?
Yes.
Dealing with media. There's a lot of caution that has to be.
Yeah, sure. The question is, what about being wise about this? Because there's an awful lot of stuff associated with this third leg that I find detestable and unattractive and phony. And it's all the above. Yeah, so for me, what I'm trying to do is just to say my job is not to try to make things happen. My job is to be faithful and pray for people. I prayed for probably 200-300 people now to get well, and I've started seeing things happen. But the first 100 or so, I didn't see much happen, except a few people got sicker. And but my promise in praying for someone is to love and bless them. It's never that they be healed, though I hunger to learn more about that. So I don't overstate this, though there are credible books that have demonstrated that this is going on in the American church. And I list some of those that you can read in the bibliography. But yes.
I think that's the good answer. You don't overstate.
Oh, I don't. No, I don't. And I am committed in my own life, if you knew me, to not acting like I'm something I'm not, and not to try to make anything happen. Otherwise, I'd feel phony about it. I don't like that. This brother, and then this lady here, and then this gentleman. Yes.
How does the naturalist respond to your misconceptions about knowledge? Like when you present the fact that you can know things without being confident, what is their response to that?
This is widely acknowledged, even among naturalists, about the nature of knowledge. There has been about 200 years of reflection, intense, serious reflection on the nature of knowledge by the philosophical community, and a consensus has been reached among professional philosophers of all stripes that knowledge not only does not require certainty, but you don't have to know how you know something before you can know it. So if we've reached anything like a consensus in professional philosophy, thank God this is one of them. Almost everybody agrees to this right now.
Including like the new atheists?
Yeah, they would agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah. They would agree. Although the new atheists are pretty illiterate philosophically. They're scientists and stuff. They don't know. You know what's embarrassing about the book? Al Plantinga, who's a professional philosopher, evaluated Dawkins' book and wrote a review of it in Books and Culture and said this would get about a B minus, C plus as a sophomore paper in undergrad. Because Dawkins, unfortunately, is a scientist. And his entire book is writing philosophy for which he has Zippo training. So I think when philosophers read their books, they say, this is really bad. This, dear sister.
When you feel as though God has given you a word for someone or a particular situation, when you're unsure that you won't come off like the people
yes.
that you and I both detest.
Yeah.
What do you do? You know you have sin in your life, as all of us do.
If you have a word for someone that is an admonition of some kind, I think the best thing to do is to keep it to yourself and to see it as God's inviting you to pray for the person. And just hold them in prayer for weeks. Now, there may come a point where you feel released to share graciously, but if it's an admonition of some kind, my first thing is to keep it to yourself and to make it a matter of concern and prayer for the person. If it's more positive, then you say, you know, I'm sensing. I'll give you an example. I spoke to a group of Asian Korean American Christians from around the country, and before I spoke, I said, Lord, is there anything you'd like to say? And there were like 140 Asian Korean Americans. And I believe the Lord said to me, there's a young man named Mike here that just had a conflict with his pastor, and he has blamed himself for that conflict, but he needs to tell the pastor that it was really wrong for what he did, and he needs to confront the situation. And so I got up and spoke, and I said, and I was afraid there wasn't anybody there named Mike, because I have never in my life met a Korean named Mike. And I actually told the Lord, I said, you know what, this would darn well better be your voice, because I'm going to be embarrassed as heck if there's no Mike here. So I shared this, and I left before I spoke and left and came back the next morning, and the guy in charge of the conference ran up to me and said, do you know what happened last night? I won't go into detail, but there was a three-hour prayer meeting that took place because the Spirit came in the meeting, and he says, have you met Mike? And I said, this guy comes up and says, basically, you have no idea what you said, but not only did this happen, but my pastor's going to be here tomorrow from New Jersey for 2 days, and that you told me this today just before he gets here tomorrow. I know I need to talk to him because I need to relieve this situation. It's unbelievable. I didn't say, thus saith the Lord. I said, I am sensing. Or does this make sense to you? I seem to be seeing or sensing. And then you offer it, and if you're wrong, you're wrong. You just do the best you can. Because New Testament words of knowledge are not like Old Testament prophecy. Those are very different things. There was this brother, yes.
With some of the 20, 30-year-olds, there's a whole movement toward social justice as part of the gospel. In fact, phrases are being used rather than the gospel of salvation, gospel of kingdom. Where does this fit into the kingdom triangle? Because they might agree to what you said.
Yes.
The whole thing is, why should kids in Africa be drinking sewage water,
yeah,
go without shoes, etc.? And we see this as part of the Luke 4.
Yeah. The gospel of the kingdom of God is a broader gospel than justification by faith. The gospel of the kingdom is an invitation to live in the kingdom now, in a new realm and from a new power. Justification by faith is the absolutely essential entrance point as to entering into that kingdom. So I always preach justification by faith against the backdrop of life in a new kingdom. Having said that, then, social justice will be one way to express the life of the kingdom. But here's my concern. I believe that what's happening to the young generation is that we have not taught enough on politics and the state. And we need to do a better job of teaching a New Testament theory of the state. Because, now you may disagree with this, but I'll just tell you right now, I am for health care and I am for social justice, but not the state doing it. because I think that it is not the job of the state to be providing things for people. And that's not because I'm a Republican. It's because I've studied the New Testament and the Old Testament. And I do not believe Israel is a model for the state. It's more of a model for the church. So how do I develop a theology of the state? Two ways. I look at the Old Testament prophets and the things they held pagan nations to, and I look at New Testament teaching. And by and large, my understanding of the state is that it protects negative rights. It doesn't give positive rights. A negative right is the right to be protected from harm when I try to get something. If healthcare is a negative right, the state has an obligation to keep me from being discriminated against. If it's a positive right, it has the obligation to give it. Now, here's the point. Whether you agree with that or disagree, we have a lot of young people that are confusing a genuine biblical concern for social justice with becoming a liberal Democrat. Now, whether you're a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican, I don't care. What I do care about is that simple slide from A to B is an unthinking slide that needs to be challenged by biblical teaching about the nature of the state.
And I wasn't asking it in relation
okay.
to that solution.
Well, then I just...
Under your three lights of a triangle, where would the part of the social justice...
It would
kind of answer
yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. Yes, thanks. Sorry.
In the first part of your lecture, you were talking about the hard sciences down in the corner of
yes.
reality. And then you also mentioned Dawkins. How does the movie Expelled relate to the first part?
Yeah, the movie Expelled is a very important movie because what it's doing is it's tugging people's sense of censorship. And no matter what, Ben Stein is not a believer. He was outraged when he discovered what's happening to scientists that teach at universities who are getting fired because they believe in intelligent design, even though they're better published than their colleagues. Why, it's nothing but bigotry. So what this movie does is it shows the bigotry of the people that claim that we need to have we need to keep control of evolutionary naturalism over our education system and not let another paradigm on the table. And I think what the movie Expelled does is shows it doesn't argue the issue in terms of whether intelligent design is true, but it basically says this is nothing but censorship and bigotry, plain and simple, and anybody who has a sense of justice ought to be on the side of giving the intelligent design people at least a chance to practice their ideas and promote them without being fired and censured. That's what the movie does. I think it's critical. Because I think what it'll do is it'll allow ID to get on the table and have a debate. Right now we can't even have a debate because the debate's silenced. It's a good, very good question. This gentleman right here. My transformation from going to non-signs and wonders to signs and wonders was first theological. I had given up cessationism years ago. And then I began to do more reading on the nature of the kingdom. And it began to dawn on me that I should be seeing more of this in and through my own ministry. And then here was the key component for me, and it's what I call, and others, the principle of credible witnesses. I began to meet and see and read people that I knew were credible and weren't inappropriately weird. Because if you open up to this, sometimes the spirit gets a little bit unusual, but inappropriately weird. And so I came across credible witnesses that weren't like the dog and pony shows, and they provided a middle ground that I thought, you know what, there's something real going on there, and I want to look into it. That's what happened to me. So the writings of Sam Storms and Jack Deere, talks with Dallas Willard, who is full on into this, and a host of other people, quite frankly, was what persuaded me that not only was this biblical, but it was really happening. That was the key for me. Credible witnesses. Yes?
Along with you mentioned Jack Deere and his books on healing, he talks a lot about how you need to practice it.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you pray for a lot of people and you got better. If it's the work of God,
it's not the work of God. Very little of what we do is the work of God. You have to understand that it's the work of God with us. The primary model for our work is co-labor. And we co-labor with God. And God does, in my own view, God doesn't just do the work and that's the end of it, or else we don't make a difference. And so prayer... the effectiveness of very little of prayer is simply asking God to do something and he does it. That's part of it. But if that were all of it, then there would be no discipline of prayer and learning to grow in it. There would be no point in learning to grow in prayer because a 5-year-old could pray as well as a 50-year-old believer who's labored over it for hundreds and thousands of hours. The truth is that prayer is a real thing that a person can learn to work with its nature. And so there are ways of learning to do our part and to pray effectively, just like preaching. If the work of transforming people was God's work, there would be no purpose in learning to preach effectively. But it isn't God's work. It's God's work with us. When I say it isn't God's work, I mean only his work. Obviously, that's what I mean. We are co-laborers with him. And so what happens is up to us as well as to him, in my own view. And that means that I need to do all I can to grow in the different things I'm doing. And I'll let him do his part, too. I mean, he'll do his part, but I want to do mine. That's the way I'd look at it, Jim. How about one more? I don't know, but I think maybe one more. Yes, sir. Okay. Yeah. Oh, I don't have a scriptural foundation. No, I don't. Well, no, I don't have a scriptural foundation. I have a philosophical foundation that follows from Scripture. Basically, the early church had a view called Traducianism, which said that it was the soul of the living thing that reproduced after its kind. And so God ensouled animals, and they reproduced after their kinds. And so it is not, strictly speaking, a biblical foundation, because the Bible doesn't teach on this, but it is a reflection on biblical teaching that is consistent with it, though not the only view. But it does show that soulishness has a difference in the traits that we have. So that would be the way of doing it. By and large, what they've discovered is that if you take the DNA out of an organism and you put the DNA of another organism in it, what grows is this organism, not this one, but it eventually dies. So that if you took a dinosaur DNA and put it in a frog cell, you'd get a frog that eventually would not make it very long. You wouldn't get a dinosaur. DNA is like a steering wheel. It needs a driver. It doesn't know what to do. It's a material supplier. It'll supply proteins at a certain place at the right time if something else tells it what to do when. And as one scientist put it, secular scientist, there's got to be a driver that tells the DNA what to do. And that driver, here's the key thing, has got to be fully present in all places all throughout the body. Well, that's the soul, because the soul is to the body as God is to space. God is not in space, but he occupies space by being fully present everywhere. Your soul is not in your body, it occupies your body, because your soul is fully present at all points of your body. That's why if you get your arm cut off, you don't lose part of your soul, because it's fully present everywhere. So the soul is in space in a different way a material object is in space. Okay, because it's got a left half that's here and a right half that's there. The soul doesn't have a left and right half. It's not extended. It's fully present throughout the body, which means that it is in every cell and can guide the DNA in every cell. It's the only kind of driver that's plausible. A good book on the myth of DNA by a non-Christian scientist is called How the Leopard Changed Its Spots by the British microbiologist Brian Goodwin. He's not a believer. I wrote a book called Body and Soul, and I have a whole chapter on this and how it relates to cloning and other things like that. Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. Bless you.
So what do you do with all that? My prayer for each of us is that we will have been stretched, but that we will also be encouraged to grow, to have the discipline, to be all that God has created us to be, and to be challenged.